So, we are, a couple things I wanted to share with you at the beginning. Sorry, it is the 18th of November, yay. I thought you'd appreciate. Did he say which one? I saw this. I didn't bring it up last week, but I saw this on The Consumerist. Yes, I know we're waiting for that. That's the point. One of the classic cyber scams, the Nigerian prince and its progeny, as they say, right? The, hello, I am X deposed spouse, friend, prince of X country. I have all of this money that I really kind of need help repatriating, and I will pay you a commission if you help me. Has anyone ever fallen for one of these? And or baited? Because there are people who respond back trying to get as much information about the scam artist. To me, they hit a new low, or high, depending on how you look at it. The other day, I got one as a message through LinkedIn email, which means that the scammers actually had to pay, right, a higher rate with LinkedIn in order to get. I was like, what? My mother once got one by fax. But apparently, this scheme, according to The Consumerist, citing the appendix, it was an old swindle back in 1898, the New York Times. So here's our story, apparently, from the New York Times from 1898, maybe. Here we go. The Spanish prisoner and buried treasure bait again being offered to unwary Americans. One of the oldest and most attractive and probably most successful swindles known to the police authorities has come again to the surface, having been brought to the attention of Anthony Comstock, president of the Society for the Prevention of Crime. And it goes through, a man in this country receives a letter from a foreign city. Havana used to be a favorite place, but it is not used now, probably because communication with it is so frequent and easy. And it says, the letter is written on thin blue cross-line paper such as is used for foreign letters and is written as fairly well-educated foreigners write English, with a word misspelled here and there and an occasional foreign idiom. The writer is always in jail because of some political offense. He always has some large sum of money hid and is invariably anxious that it should be recovered and used to take care of his young and helpless daughter by some honest man. He knows of the prudence and good character of the recipient of the letter through a mutual friend, whom he does not mention for reasons of caution, and appeals to him in time of extremity for help. He is willing to give 1/3 of the concealed fortune to the man who will recover it, remove the daughter to this country, and see that what is left is managed for her benefit. Okay. So, there are lots of different ways that this can make money and could make money back in 1898. Parenthetically, Anthony Comstock, who at the time was the president of the Society for the Prevention of Crime, I believe eventually either became Postmaster General or the head of the inspectors of the post office, and as such was known very well for the investigation and prohibition of pornography through the mails. Comstock Act. So he was sort of an early media censor. But before that, he was the president of the Society for the Prevention of Crime. And so the idea is either, in some cases, you know, could you send me a little money to help me? few thousand dollars, but you'll get back a million. Or there are different versions of this. Sometimes one gets a check to be deposited. Could you send me the proceeds immediately? And then when it clears, you know, here's a check for $4 million on a foreign bank. So all, you know, send me a million or $10,000, send me $2,000 now. And once the check clears, all of it's yours. But of course, the check will never clear. At the extreme end, people have been lured to foreign countries, at which point they are kidnapped and ransomed and all sorts of things happen to them. But ultimately, this used the semi-anonymous, generic, low-cost communications medium of the day and took advantage of delays in other media. When this was done in 1898 and prior to that, the fastest mode of commonly available communication was postal mail. Yes, there were some international telegraph cables. Probably at 1898, telephone cables, if there were, they were very, very rare because there weren't a whole lot of phones on the other end. There was no radio, let alone intercontinental radio. But the mails got through. And they were commonplace, and people didn't think twice about them. And to a certain vulnerable set of part of the population, this was a way of cheating them. And so it is true today. So it is true today. I have to wonder, because I have a fairly strong spam filter, and I never actually look. So I don't know whether I'm still getting... Anybody get one of these today?
We had one, yeah.
Oh, I know the one you mean. Right, they're that's the... But that's different. I know that there was at least one faculty email account that was hacked the other week. And you got the, I'm stranded in Turkey... It wasn't quite clear what one is supposed to do with that. But the difference, right? What's the difference between substantively? Happily, Professor Silver wasn't stranded in Turkey. What's the difference substantively? How does that crime happen or occur? What are you supposed to do?
You're under this the impression that it's coming from the person that you
Right, but it actually, no, you're wrong. Well, you're right. Person, yes. But where did it actually come from? Right, so you'll notice what particularly what makes that other scam so tempting, right? So likely to get results is that it isn't from a stranger. There is no contact information in the body of that message. So you're supposed to respond back. Well, I'm writing to Professor Silver, Professor Silver's email address, that I know it. I'm not going to worry about it, except what's the problem?
You're not talking to him. You're talking to somebody else.
Because someone else has maliciously hacked into his email and is able to read those, intercept them, and respond. And they've probably changed his password, so he can't. So that's one level of scam. We have to look to see if I've gotten this, because I certainly wouldn't have done it. But the point here is, there is nothing new under the sun. I thought that was a very interesting point. And as technology advances, so too does do criminals catch up. And they will use whatever is available to them. When we had postal mail, it was postal mail. Telephones, we had phone scams. We still have phone scams. Now, once the internet, the first spam email, It actually wasn't an email. Well, there was a spam email. Anyone know what the first major spam was? Unsolicited bulk commercial advertising? Two lawyers in Arizona who posted to something like 6,000 of the 10,000 Usenet discussion groups about the green card lottery back in, I believe, April of 1994. They were subsequently disbarred. Then they moved into internet marketing as a profession. Didn't do so well. But those people will always seek to take advantage of the vulnerabilities of a particular system, the benefits to criminals of a particular system. Credit cards, great. But now we can use credit cards over the phone. So how do you stop and people could just come up with numbers, and then we have to put another number on the card that doesn't show up on the bill. But you share that with enough people and it gets into an insecure database, and that's gone. Over and over and over again. So things are constantly changing, and the criminals are constantly changing, which is why I will not be asking you about most of the cases in the book on the final exam. Final exam is the 19th of December, which means it is a month and a day from now. 3 hours, at least as scheduled. We'll talk about that in half a second. I intend to give you 7 essay questions. Most of them will likely be fact patterns. Here's a fact pattern. It will not be a simple fact pattern. There will be lots of twists and turns along the way. And then there will be one or a series of questions arising out of that fact pattern. What are the legal issues here? Who's got a claim and against whom? What are the challenges that law enforcement or a victim might face here? What are the defenses that the alleged perpetrator might use? Those sorts of questions. And it will require you to continue as you've been, to think like a lawyer, to think about issues of jurisdiction, think about issues of statute and which statutes might apply. Excuse my lisp, a little talked out after yesterday. And then to write a cohesive essay. You get to choose the 4 questions of the 7 with which you are most comfortable. I want to see you think, and I want to see you write. This is not just about the answer, although that is a critically important part. This is about your ability to be effective in writing given the limitations of time. 4 complete essays. They will not be well researched, because you won't be able to. They will not be as well edited as you might be able to were you to have more time, but a lawyer needs to be ready to write effectively under whatever conditions to the best possible level. The way I grade, if you haven't, and I don't think any of you has had one of my exams yet, but the way I grade these types of exams, for each question, I will have in my mind the basic level of answer. The issues that you should have spotted if you had a basic understanding of the material we have read and discussed. And I will set a grade in the B-ish range for an effective answer that hits the essentials. If you hit more, because there's always going to be something else in the question, some hook, some additional, if you think about it a little bit, more answer. The more you get, the more you see and analyze correctly and put into your essay, the better your grade's going to be. The more things you get incorrect, For example, if the question were about something arising out of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, and you said that by accessing this account without authorization, this person violated the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. Well, we know that none of those offenses in 18 U.S.C. 1030 stops with accesses without authorization or exceeding authorization. All of them require more than that as an element of the particular offense. So if you say to me in your essay, by accessing the account without information, that person has committed a crime under this law, that will be wrong. And that will mark you down from the basic level. If you don't give me four essays, the best you can hope for is a 75. Because I grade each one on a scale of 1 to 100, add them up and divide by 4. So that way, if you have a really solid, you know, because if I just did it on 1 to 25 scale and then added them, there isn't enough gradation. Because you might have a really solid answer on one and not so much on the others. I want to give you as much of a chance as possible to get the total grade. And so I round up. I average down, I average by, and then I round up. So if you have an 89.6, on an average, you've got a 90. Because I have bothered all of you and I've encouraged all of you to participate, I don't tend to do participation grades up or down. I will be looking at the attendance because I'm required to. And if any of you has a significant number of absences, we may need to talk. Because I'm not even sure I'm supposed to allow you to take the exam if you have more than X percent. I could look at that. But ultimately, that's the challenge. I'm not looking for you to memorize. I want to see you think. So anything you could bring on paper, you may use as reference material. Your notes, printing out, whatever you want to print. I say on paper because once we introduce devices, it's a lot harder to control. Now, that is the plan. There is an alternative. I'm not doing a paper as an alternative. But the other way I can do this is give you the same kind of questions, the same requirements, 24 hours to do it, but I will tell you before you start saying, and so that would be posted towards the beginning of exam period, it would be due no later than the end of the last scheduled exam. So you'd have to start, if you wanted a full 24 hours, no later than exactly 24 hours before the end. So if the end of the last, I don't know, I think, is this the last day of the 19th?
Friday, the 20th.
So whatever the last moment of the last exam on the 20th would be the absolute drop dead due date. Before you decide, I will grade those much more stringently because you will have much more time to think about your essay, to edit your essay, and so on. You're still not allowed to look things up online. Not that it'll help you much, but the difference really is in the amount of time. This is not a 3-hour exam that you have 24 hours to finish. I grade them differently. I'm good either way. Yeah. I'm not doing an either or, though.
We opted together for the take-home. We would get, like, I think the last test on Friday must have, like,
12:30, something like that.
So we would get it on Thursday, 12:30.
No. I would post it by the beginning of exam period. You would be able to, that's the benefit. You would be able to pick which 24 hours. I do it through TWEN. It's anonymous. You check out the exam. You download it, and then you submit your answers in Microsoft Word format, I think, no more than 24 hours after you have downloaded it through your TWN account. So it's submitted, and then at the end of the period, I download all of them and read them and grade them by number. I mean, it's anonymous either way. So no, this is not, it's not, it doesn't have to be the same date. But I will be Democratic small d, and I'll let majority rule. And if there's a tie, I'll decide. So, how many of you would prefer doing an in-class 3-hour?
Can we take a vote next week?
Yes. Yes, you may do so. We will determine this at the beginning of class next week. All right? Again, there are definite drawbacks to both. If you were planning on handwriting your exam, you certainly can't if it's take-home. Have any of you, are any of you planning to handwrite exams? Okay, so keep that in mind. Like I say, I grade those more stringently. So it's entirely up to you. Any other, yep.
If I download the exam, and within 3 hours, if I complete the exam...
Put it up again. But that's
still,
it.
Would you still score it differently?
Oh, yes. Because you have... Whether or not you decide to take three, you have up to 24, and it will be evaluated as if you took up to 24. Or at least, you don't have... Not 24 hours worth of writing, but more than a 3-hour, 4-essay push. I anticipate that a 24-hour window gives you time to carefully edit. Yeah.
Can we do it on the weekend?
I will put it up there and I will get it at the end.
Okay.
I have, right, so if you really, really like doing things on Saturdays, obviously this makes that possible in a way that other things wouldn't, but we'll see how all this goes. All right? Yes, I will be more stringent. Let's put it the other way. If I know you're pushing to get 4 essays done in 3 hours, if you misspell something, okay. Now, I know if any of you has ever taken Professor Shaw, I know there's certain words where if you misspell them, you want to have an automatic F.
What?
I don't. If you spell cyber with an I, I think we're going to have a problem. You spell ESO wrong, for sure you have a problem. But other than that, I don't think we have that sort of situation. But it's not just spelling. Grammar, sentence structure, organization. You know, it's not that I'm giving you a pass if you've got it a 3 hours. But I know you don't have time necessarily to go back and carefully edit in 3 hours the same as much as you could in up to 24. So that's really how this balances. If you want to see the type of exam I give, I do not, I believe, have a cybercrime exam on file, but my first cyber law exam should be there. You won't know a lot of the, first of all, it's based on a 2003 version of the book that I was using then, but don't worry so much about the questions asked, because many of them will deal with issues we have not talked about because it was a different class. Look at how the questions are structured. The fact patterns, the types of questions. That if you want to get a sense of what you're going to get from me when you open the exam book or download the exam, that's the type of exam that I want to give, because I think it evaluates. And what do you need to know? That's the other question everybody asks. The case is, if you refer to them to bolster your argument, and you do so correctly, that can help. As far as statutes go, we're talking about the Copyright Act today. That's good law. You need to understand at least the portions of it which we discuss. I will expect you to be familiar and conversant with those. The Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. We spent 2 classes on it. We looked at its provisions very carefully. 18 U.S.C. 1030. I expect you to understand that and know it. We discussed at some length the provisions of the Electronic Communications Privacy Act, ECPA. You can go back and look at the slides, listen to the podcast, read the book, the Wiretap Act, Pen Register Statute, and the Stored Communications Act. I expect you to be conversant with those. Every little element, no. But to know whether it's a wiretap or a stored communication issue or none of the above, that I do want you to know, and tell me about it. Content versus non-content, wiretap versus pen register. The issue of the kind of legal process you might need to serve an internet service provider with. What the difference is between a remote computing service and electronic communication service, because so many of the cases in that section dealt with that difference. And since it's open materials, you don't have to memorize those statutes. Those are the sorts of things. And, of course, the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. Printing that out, having it available, probably a good idea. You know, there's some important words in there. And some of the exceptions we went over in great detail, the exceptions to the warrant requirement. That's the level of statutory material. Plus, along the way, we've talked about some others. Take a look at your notes. But the cases, I'm not looking, this is not International Shoe. This is not Brown versus the Board of Education. These are not, most of them, precedent. I mean, you've seen how many different courts, and we don't even have the whole case anyway. This is about the type of analysis. The questions that are raised when a police officer gets a phone and whether there's an exception. That's the kind of thing. And I've, along the way, I've been giving you some sort of sample exam situations to try to prime that pump. All of the audio will be available. To the extent we had PowerPoints for a few classes we didn't, those will be available. There will be no. If there is a question about our guest lecturer, it will be a standalone question. It will be more of a thought piece. Sometimes, I have to decide, sometimes I like to give thought pieces as opposed to fact pieces. It's very difficult because it's very difficult for me to evaluate one person's answer versus another. So I haven't decided yet, but that's sort of where we go with this. Yeah?
Well, anything of Mark saying?
Well, that's what I just said. If there's something there, it may be of value, go for it. But, you know, it won't be, I won't necessarily expect you to bring it in. Although, who knows, maybe there'll be something about a lawyer or someone who's provided with top secret documents. And maybe you can bring in some of what was discussed, at least as a concept. Right. So that's our exam. Yep?
Last one. Do you have a recommendation outside of the book for like practice questions or anything like that?
No.
Okay.
My recommendation is you go pull that cyber law exam I have on file.
Okay.
Because those are the types of questions you're going to see. The book has lots of notes and questions. And I do, if I'm trying to figure out what to ask, because the last time I taught this class, I used a different book. It went in a different order. So I need to go back and see whether those questions are necessarily used. I'll change something about them in any event. But I may look to those as well, but don't assume you're going to see them in, you know, as drafted format. Take a look at them. That's what this author thought was worth thinking about from these readings. One last note about the exam. Because I give you my PowerPoints, and more to the point, because I give you audio recordings of every class, I do not want and will not think well of someone. I do not want a simple recitation in your essay of what I said. If all I see you telling me is exactly what I told you, because it means you took good notes about, you know, good transcription, or you spend 4 pages of a 5-page essay putting down sections from a statute, and I know it's an open materials exam, to me that says you're stalling. You don't know. You don't have anything to add, and so you're trying to fill this. Don't fill the space. Really, it will not. I know what I said, and if I forget, I can always go back and listen. And I don't need you and don't want you to waste time, whichever way we do this exam, giving me long sections from a statute. You could refer to a particular phrase. You could give me a line if it's relevant. But more than that, you're wasting your own time. I want to see you think. All right? I know, it's never good, but I try to be as fair and as open as possible and give you guys the best shot to show me that you've learned something as possible. And hopefully it will all come together. And we are not, of course, on a mandatory curve. And I don't tend to curve things if I don't have to. So you could all do very well. You could all do really poorly. I'm grading everybody against my sort of hypothetical where I think the answer should be. And I try to read over everything once before I start grading, if I have time, to see if everybody gets the same thing wrong, means I taught it wrong. And then that's not your fault. So my philosophy of exams, your mileage may differ, void where prohibited. Okay, on to the topic at hand, theft of intellectual property. Why do I suspect that the readings in these chapters, particularly the Napster case, resonated with some of you? Maybe it's because 10 years ago, when I was supplementing my income doing home computer repair, every time I had to fix a teenager's computer, it was because Napster or LimeWire had dumped all sorts of other stuff on the computer that was making it not work right. And once those went away, so did the problem. I'm not even talking about the legal stuff. I'm talking about all the other programs and utilities and weather bugs and God only knows what else. You know that, trying to think which race this was. Whether it was the state attorney general's race or maybe a gubernatorial primary. About 5-6 years ago, I was watching the debate among the candidates on News 12, and the question was asked, has any of you ever illegally downloaded any music? It was the have you ever smoked pot of the current generation. And I know that to the extent that any of you in your wayward youths did this, it was because you didn't really understand the legal issues, or you did and decided you were a rebel. It's not particularly a good idea, obviously, especially if you're planning on running for elective office in the modern era. But it really, just this whole notion, and really we're talking here about, when we talk theft of IP, they're talking about copyright. Two legal doctrines, what, theft and intellectual property. I take it that none of you has completed an intellectual property course here yet? You're taking it now. Right, because of, you're all, most, if not all of you, second year students, and, okay, so I'm not assuming any broad grounding. It wasn't a requirement for this course. But these two notions aren't necessarily the traditional definition, and we've talked about this, of theft doesn't necessarily fit here. In the traditional sense, there is an object. It is in the possession, lawful possession of an owner, or a user, a renter, whatever. Someone else takes possession without operation of law. That is defined as theft. Who has the object once that action has occurred? What? Really? If your car is stolen, you still have a car? The thief does. The thief has possession. That idea of portability is essentially the differentiating factor between real property and personal property. Personal property can be moved and can be stolen. Real property, one can rob from a house very hard outside of certain tornado vulnerable neighborhoods with double wides. It's very hard to steal a house. Theft, as a concept, has embedded within it the idea that the thief now has the thing and the former possessor doesn't anymore. Doesn't have it to use, doesn't have it to sell or rent. All those bundle of rights that represent ownership, gone. How does that play out in the notion of copyright? How do these cases define theft of copyrighted material? What does it mean to steal a song? Who has the song? At the beginning of the process, who has the song? In the Napster case, who had the song? What does that mean to have the song? Right. Where was the song? What was the song? What was it that was stolen? Well, what was stolen was the money that would have been earned by the seller of the license to play the song, had all of the people who ended up with a copy of the song chosen to pay for it in order to receive it legally. It's kind of complicated. It's not you took it. Kindergartners don't infringe. They take. Or at least nursery school. By kindergarten, you learn you don't take my stuff. But in all those, you remember that thing that's gone around, right? All these things I learned in kindergarten? That's right up there. You've never seen. There's a book. And everything I need to know I learned in kindergarten. There's another one that parents pass around. Rules of like a preschooler. If it's mine, it's mine. If it's yours and I like it, it's mine. If it's yours and I see it, it's mine, and so on. But they don't infringe. The idea of infringement. What does infringement mean? What does that mean in this context? What is infringement of copyright? What does that word mean? Anybody know? What does infringement mean generally? None of you can even give us dictionary definition or your definition. Go ahead. What does infringement mean?
This is way off,
wait, stop. Why? Why would you think that your answer as a thoughtful tuition-paying law student is way off for defining an English word? That does not show the confidence that you merit having. So give us the answer, now that I've put a little pressure on you. That is certainly one definition of infringement, of personal space, right? You're infringing on my personal space here. I have teenagers. But in the context of rights, yes, it is essentially someone utilizing one's rights without permission. That's really what infringement is. And when it comes to intellectual property, what is intellectual property? Really thoughtful phones? You know, they have a pipe, a little smoke, and a jacket, and they're reading Shakespeare. What does that mean, intellectual property?
Ideas or tangible.
Well, see, that's the problem. Tangible, the tangibility might be a requirement for protection, but in fact, that's only a representation of the intellectual property. What's intellectual property? So let's be more general. Yeah, and in that format, intellectual property is intangible, at least in its creation. It's an idea or the expression of an idea, an invention, something that has arisen from cognitive thought rather than something that has been constructed. Now you can build an embodiment Something that takes that idea, that expression, and creates something that can be held. You have an invention, great. You make a prototype. That is required, at least to be able to build a prototype, to reduce it to practice in order to get patent protection, to get protection under the law, because you have to be able to say, which thing are we talking about? When it comes to creative works, music, books, computer software, yes, they exist. But the only way the law can allow them to be protected is if they are reduced to some level of tangibility. A copy of it is put in a tangible form. And so there are certain kinds of art forms in particular that don't lend themselves all that well to tangibility. For example, dance. Has anyone here been in the dance world? I don't mean in a club, but in the ballet or other jazz, or you have? As a kid or now, or as a...
kid in high school.
Okay. Were you taught dances?
Yeah.
How were you taught those dances?
The teachers.
Okay. Were any of those dances like classic, previously choreographed, like the Nutcracker?
I assume so, yeah.
Okay. How were those transmitted? Because dances can be protected. A certain person's choreography is protectable, but only if it is reduced to tangible form. Today, of course, you can videotape a dance, video record a dance, and therefore, but how did they do it? Do you know? Before we had video recordings, how did they reduce to tangibility and therefore protect choreography? Yeah, maybe if you're learning the samba. But I don't think that when, you know, the classic choreography of the Nutcracker or the dance suite from Oklahoma or pick your, you know, whatever, Jerome Robbins' choreography for this or that and the other thing, I don't think those were cut out of feet along the stage floor. It's very distracting for the audience. Howard, did anybody know? You're getting there. How is music? Before we could record music, how was it that people outside of Vienna could play? Mozart was Vienna, right? Or was it Beethoven? I always get that confused. Outside of wherever the composer was, could play the composition. Sheet music. How is it that player pianos could play? Punched holes that represented the song. Similarly with ballet. There is a notation format, the equivalent of musical notes for dance moves. I don't know it, but it exists. And so choreographers, once they have created their choreography, especially in the classical jazz and those sorts of dance genres, annotate. They actually write down their choreography. And that's protectable. And so if someone else produces a ballet or a show with those dance moves, whether or not there was a video recording or film of the original, the choreographer could say, here are my notations, I have them protected, you may not use them without my permission. So infringement in the sense of intellectual property is doing one of the things that the intellectual property owner has the right to control without permission. A copyright is just like ownership of real property or ownership of property is a bundle of rights, so too is ownership of a copyright or a patent or a trademark. It is a list of exclusive rights. And the holder of those exclusive rights has one of the rights is to grant or withhold permission. So someone who has invented something that is protected by a patent has the right to make the invention, to sell the invention, to license, permit others to use the invention, to permit others to make it, to permit others to sell it, or to say they may not. It's a limited monopoly. So how is theft? How does theft come into this? How do you steal as opposed to how do you infringe? What's the difference? Is there one?
With theft, you no longer have a possessory interest in whatever the person's taking, whereas with infringement, you could both concurrently hold the thing that it is that they're taking. Like with a copyright, you could have the right to a writing, and somebody could copy that right and then copy the writing itself, and then you both have the tangible form of the writing.
Right. Okay, if that's the definition, then explain the Napster case. Explain why all of these cases are under the heading of theft of intellectual property. Was it that the music rights owners, the publishers or composers of the songs, and the performers of the songs no longer had something? Were their songs stolen? Yes or no? In your definition of theft.
I would say in my definition.
In your definition of theft.
They were infringed upon.
They were infringed upon, but yet, these are crimes. These are felonies. There is a crime of criminal copyright infringement. And certainly, if you ask them, they're stealing these songs. Theft of intellectual property is different from traditional theft because it can be theft. And generally, the difference between taking something and stealing something is that one, the latter is covered under the criminal law and the former isn't. You have the tort of conversion. Remember the tort of conversion? What's the tort of conversion? No, it isn't stealing something. It's taking something without permission. It's a tort. It's a civil tort. Now, that act may also give rise to a complaint of theft, of criminal theft, or it may not. If that action of taking fits in the definition of theft, it's both. If not, just like conversely, we have murders where whether or not there's an acquittal, there may also be a civil rights violation and a civil lawsuit. We've seen many examples of that even in the past 25 years. High profile cases, there's a criminal acquittal and a civil judgment against the alleged perpetrator, who then, I guess, is the perpetrator under the criminal, under the civil, O.J. Simpson. It is no longer potentially libelous to say that O.J. Simpson murdered Ron Brown and Nicole Simpson. Why is it not? Because the Brown family won their civil suit. You could say it before the civil suit, but you certainly couldn't say he was a convicted murderer because he wasn't. Different situations. So here, is theft different from infringement? The act may be the same. In both circumstances, it is likely to be a copy was made or it was marketed without permission. But if it also falls under a criminal statute of some kind, it can be theft. And why is this? Why are we talking about this in cybercrime? What is it about computers and the internet that makes this a chapter, makes this so ripe for? When you ask people, probably before you walked into this room, if you thought about you taking cybercrime, or you told someone, they would have said, oh, like stealing songs? Why is it that that notion is so connected? What is it about computers and the internet that changed intellectual property infringement into something that could really be theft?
The sharing and downloading of music is almost exclusive to computers.
Why?
Because
did it not happen before computers? You guys are too young to remember, most of you.
Oh, yeah, I would know.
you would not know. Okay, fair enough. Anybody remember from your American history classes what happened before computers?
Put a tape in.
You'd put a tape. Those rectangular things. Little magnetic tape, magnetic particles on plastic on two spools. And a magnet would run across, and it would change the magnetic particles. And if you read those that changes, it would actually turn into sound. And then they had these big round black vinyl things that spun around and around, either 33 and a third times in a minute, or 45 times in a minute, or 70 times in a minute if you go back. And those things were hard for people to produce at home. Elvis had to go to the local recording studio to record a little song for his mama, right? But we all could buy these tape players, especially once in the early 70s, we moved from reel-to-reel tapes and 8-tracks, which no one ever actually recorded. They were a very bizarre portable play thing, to these cassettes. And suddenly, one friend would have an album, buy a record from the record store, and five people would have the album. My whole, whether or not I downloaded music, I didn't have a stereo, but I did have a tape player. My friend Pam was a very good recording person, so I had a lot of Maxell XL290s. I had, Billy Joel the Stranger, Billy Joel Piano Man. You could fit an entire LP on one side, I played it on my little mono tape player, whatever. So it's not as if copying music didn't exist before the internet. It did. What's the difference? Why weren't there massive lawsuits against Maxell for the XL290s? Or, Sanyo or Sharp for the dual tape decks where you could push one button and record, copy one tape to another? What's the difference between an album recorded onto a cassette and a CD that's ripped and then distributed?
Transmission.
What do you mean?
You can spread it quickly in less amount of time to a bigger mass of people.
So one is we're all broadcasters, potentially. So it's no longer one to one. It's one to a million, instantly. That is, in fact, one major difference, the cyber part. What about computers?
What about quality of recording?
Go with that, because that's the other answer.
The VHS tape, it's not the best quality, but if you're going digital, if you're making a copy, it's going to be exact or extremely close to...
No, it will be exact. That's the other part of this, and why copying from an LP to a Maxell to XL290, whatever, a cassette, is qualitative, literally qualitatively different from taking a CD and burning another CD. If you record from an LP, that's a long playing record, to a cassette, every scratch, every pop, every dust particle that has made it onto that LP, plus the electric hum, because it's a really bad electrical connection, all of that's going to be recorded. And after you play the tape over and over again, the tape stretches out, it gets muddy, you walk past a magnet, you're screwed. All of that stuff, gone, done. And even though you'd be willing to buy an LP, as long as it's new, the market for used LPs is not particularly good back then. And even were it legal, nobody was going to buy a copy of a copy of a copy on a cassette because the quality would be lousy. Analog, digital, every sound translated into zeros and ones. Those zeros and ones just have to be duplicated on another media, in another medium, on another device, or on another disc, exactly as long as, 01001, 01001, exactly the same. The millionth copy as good as the first. So the commercial value, the commercial competitive, now, it's not to say it's perfect. For example, we have compression. One of the ways that that especially in the past when people had slower connections, one of the ways they dealt, and computer memory was expensive. How do you deal with getting a lot of music on a small amount of memory? You compress it. You do reduce the quality. MP3 is the third version of the motion, I think it's the motion picture compression format, MPEG. Motion picture, what is the EG stand for? Something group, entertainment group or something? Engineering group? Experts group. So you had MPEG, the motion picture experts group, the moving pictures experts group, a bunch of engineers that said, okay, we've got this much information, how can we reduce it in size while still making it good enough? Right? And then we got a little better, we did MPEG 2. And then we got even better, we did MPEG 3, and that's really when music started being distributed. And there are other versions, Apple has its own sort of version, but MPG, right? Or MP3 is the third version of the MPEG standard. Then they got even better. The fourth version is what they use for video. You could use it for music too, but you don't really have to bother. Video takes up more space than sound. So even while, those people who claim to be audiophiles, hear the difference between an LP version and a modern CD version. Early CDs, they were very tinny. They got the technology better. Even if you can hear the difference between a full CD version and the MP3 version of the same song, the MP3 version is good enough. It's not crackly. It's not digitized. It's just there are a few, the highs aren't quite as high, the lows aren't quite as low, but it's good enough. The market shows you it's good enough because that's the format in which things are sold. And so, yes, there is a reduction in quality, but not one that has been legally relevant. So we have this whole idea. First, you have to figure out, does theft apply to intellectual property? And where the law was before computers and the internet was, if people are doing this to make money, if they're bootlegging, to sell, they're counterfeiting. What's the difference between a bootleg and a counterfeit? Well, bootleg sometimes is because the recording itself was illegal. But what's the difference between your friend making a copy and a counterfeit? The counterfeit someone's passing off as the legitimate commercial item. My friend Pam never passed off the recording as the cassette you could buy from Sam Goody's. Yes, there used to be a store. Why was it that, so there were crimes because people used to try to make money selling fakes as if they were real. And why did they charge money? They want to make money, but why else did they charge money? Because it cost money to buy blank things and to print. And I think we talked about the LaMachia case, that the law had to change because suddenly the amount of copying that one could do wasn't just one-to-one. It could have been one-to-many. But people were giving this stuff away because it didn't cost them anything to do it digitally and distribute it online. They had to change the law. And we see our discussion in the book. When the book goes through the copyright law, and this is, if you look at page 513, and particularly 515. Notice, this is looking at 18 USC. This is the criminal part of copyright infringement. Well, it's not actually 18 USC, but it refers to 18 USC 223.19, so you have the punishment part, right? The penalty is in the criminal law. So this shows you this is the criminal part of the Copyright Act. Look at the conditions at the top of 515. One of these three, remember elements of the offense? If the exam or real life should pose the question, is this a crime or is this just infringement? This is where you look to determine, is it a crime or is it just infringement? And look at the three alternatives. These are one of these, but only at least one must apply. This is not an and, it's an or. Either you look to intent. The infringement must be for commercial advantage or private financial gain. So you don't have to have made money, but you had to be trying to make money. An inept salesman selling infringed copyrighted works is still a criminal, just a really bad at it criminal. Two, push B. The infringer reproduced or distributed during any 180-day period one or more copies or phono records, which is not actually a record, but it means a sound recording, of one or more copyrighted works with a total retail value of more than $1,000. That does not talk about commercial gain, commercial advantage. It doesn't say that person had to sell them to receive more than $1,000. What is the relevant measure? Retail value. You begin to start seeing how peer-to-peer sharing can generate criminal complaints. Because let's say someone has on his or her computer an album, a complete album, and that album retails for $12.99. Now let's make it easy. $10, $9.99. In 180 days, well, if it were $9.99, here's the interesting rate. In 180 days, if 100 copies of that $9.99 album were distributed because people made copies from that person's computer, would this be violated? No. No. Because 100 times $9.99 is $999. You're still a buck short. You don't throw in sales tax. That 101st copy, though, boom, crime. 100 copies, infringement. 101 copies, crime. Same circumstances. Or distributing, quote, a work being prepared for commercial distribution by making it available on a publicly accessible computer network if the person knew or should have known that the work was intended for commercial distribution. What's this about? What's this about? What? It's not. Nope. Because all of the songs that were in the Napster case were in commercial distribution. What is a work being prepared for commercial distribution? What do you think? Exactly. Pre-release. Pre-release movies, pre-release albums, pre-release whatever it is. When the David R. Kelly pilot for the Wonder Woman series leaked all 18 minutes of it with the strings still visible. That was a work being prepared for commercial distribution. Why would the copyright law make a separate offense, or one of the elements, right, a separate element, work being prepared for commercial distribution? What differentiates that from a work that's in commercial distribution? What do you think? They're both protected. Protection is not the issue. If it's not covered under copyright law, it doesn't fall into this at all. What's the difference? Yes. Why is that used as a difference?
I was going to say because copyright is a
true.
Perhaps there could be an argument that it wasn't fully developed.
No.
No,
because again, if it weren't protected under copyright law from the moment of creation, then this wouldn't apply. This wouldn't apply because this is about copyrighted works. What's the difference? What's the difference between a leaked film and a film in the movie theaters in terms of the impact on the owner? A leaked film before it gets to the movie theater, what? Money. What do you mean by money? You're right, but why? Exactly. The copyright law, thank you, the copyright law is intended to provide financial incentives for creators. It comes out of the U.S. Constitution in order to encourage the creative and someone come up with the exact wording. It's in, I think, is it Article 3 or second Article 8, Section 8, something like that. But it's patent and copyright are the reason that Congress is directed to enact a law is in order to encourage innovations, creativity, allow creative people to earn enough money to eat by selling their work. And by keeping other people from selling it without paying them for it. The commercial impact on an act of an act of infringement is a very relevant part here. And as much as an artist may suffer hypothetical lost sales if his or her album already available is also distributed free, how much more so might those sales suffer if before $1 could be paid, people could already get it for free? Or, and it's not just that, what if it's critically panned? It leaks, and before it could even be marketed, people have said it's not very good. All those initial sales are gone. So you have three possible situations here. Someone intends to make money through the infringement. That's one possible element that establishes criminal liability. Two, within a rolling 180-day window, the commercial retail value of the item or items that were copied or distributed exceed $1,000. Or three, the nature of the work itself, or the status of the work, it is meant for sale, but it's not for sale yet. The other piece of why you need that third one is, what's the retail value of an item that has never been sold? How do you know? How can the copyright holder demonstrate retail value if he or she can't say, we're selling it and people are buying it for X? So that's why you have to, because otherwise there's a loophole. You get the stuff before it's on the marketplace, you distribute it without charging for it, no intent to make a buck, no commercial value. They had to write that in because that little loophole. So we've talked about what copyright is. What I'm going to do is really move quickly here through it. For those of you who have not taken intellectual property yet, be aware of two very important facts. First, as we've already heard, the legal protection of our copyright law exists as soon as an eligible work is created. The moment that the pen leaves the paper, the moment the words appear on the screen, the moment the last chord is played in the song and it's complete, it is fully protected by U.S. copyright law. You don't have to file anything for that protection to be valid. You don't have to label anything for protection to be valid. You just have to have created something of a sufficiently, of a sufficient level of creativity and some sort of tangible embodiment. So it's not said that the song, if you're just playing a song, it is eligible for copyright as soon as you play the last chord. The moment you write down the last note or push stop on the recording, that's when it is protected by copyright. Why does one file with the Copyright Office, which one does? Because the earlier one files after the creation and before an infringement, the greater the amount of statutory damages, or even any statutory damages, the owner can get because of the infringement, because the infringer is felt to be on notice or potential notice that someone claims the copyright. Someone claims ownership in this thing. Creator holds the copyright, or the creator's regular employer. In any other circumstance, in order for copyright to transfer, there needs to be some sort of writing. This is more relevant in your contracts classes, in the business technology law externship, in real life, in the business side of copyright, but just letting you know. And there are these exclusive rights. It's not just copying, retransmitting, broadcasting, adapting, all of those rights, public performance, they're exclusive to the copyright holder to use, to not use, to share, to not share. And musical recordings and software have been incorporated into the protections of the copyright law. Doesn't protect titles, logos and slogans, not ideas, only the particular expression. Movie about a sheriff, you know, to say, my idea is that there's a sheriff who is the last man, last good man in an old west town, and he succeeds in beating off the bad guys. That's an idea. The particular script you write, whether it's High Noon, whether it's that Doctor Who episode, whatever it is, that's the protected bit of it. And if two people create the same song and neither has ever heard the other's song or could have heard the other song, both are valid copyrightable works. You don't have to prove someone actually did hear it in order to show infringement. You have to prove, A, they're substantially similar, and B, the alleged infringer could have heard it. It was publicly played, it was on the radio, it was a big hit. They had access. Quickly, some copyright myths that you should just be aware of. There is no amount of changing or piece of it versus the whole that one can take that eliminates copyright protection. The protection stays the same. If you change it, you adapt it, you take a book and turn it into a movie, the holder of the copyright in the book holds the copyright in the movie or has the right to license it to the movie makers. The classic example I always point out to my students, the Obama Hope poster from the 2008 election, that Shepherd Fairey Hope poster, you know the one. Ultimately, it was determined that Shepherd Fairey took the pose, the lighting, the hair, the everything. There was an AP photographer who shot a picture of either Senator or candidate Obama. The picture made the news. Fairey saw this is a great image, created his poster derived from that image. He didn't trace it, but it was that shot of Obama. Fairey ultimately, not only did he lose the copyright case because it was an adaptation, he was actually convicted of, criminal contempt because he hid evidence from the court.
One makes like a spoof.
Satire is different. There is an exception to infringement for satire, but it really has to be satire. Weird Al songs do not need permission because they are legitimate satire.
Okay, so what if not satire? Let's say it's like a t-shirt that uses a logo of like a sports team or something like that, but like makes it different. But it's not for profit. It's just like entertainment.
we'll get to profit or not in a second, because I want to talk about these things. It does come up, but I know we have these cases, but it really, from my mind, it's critical for you to understand the relevant law here, and that's copyright law. Just because you can get at it, just because you don't have to pay to get at it, doesn't mean that you're permitted to do it. Can and may are two very different verbs. You need to make sure that even if the person or the place from which you were getting this work says, oh, sure, go ahead, that that person or place had the right to give you the work, to let you use it. Whether or not you pay for it, it has nothing to do with the status of the copyright protection. It just may be that the creator doesn't feel like charging for it. But it doesn't mean that there are no rights. Free of charge does not mean free of restriction. This stuff is a little less relevant in terms of the media. Licenses, you have to make sure it covers. Fair use, which I'll get to in a second, is not what people think it is. So then there are two particular, so it's sort of general copyright, and you should know copyright is managed by the Library of Congress. The patents and trademarks are in the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. There is no U.S. Copyright Office. It's an office within the Library of Congress. And it's the Librarian of Congress, the Librarian of Congress, who actually makes certain determinations under copyright law. So there are a couple of additional bits of copyright law. I want you to understand generally what kinds of things are copyright protected. And we've seen which types of infringement are crimes relevant for the class. Couple of other things you need to understand, and they actually come up here. The first is part of what was called the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, passed within the last 13 years, as you can see. Once it became clear that digital stuff and networks and computers were making a difference, they had to do things like figure out whether downloading was retransmitting or publicly performing. Which of the rights of a copyright holder were being infringed? They had to define that stuff. But they also came up with a separate offense. It is not an infringement. It is not, when they talk about it as being part of the copyright law, yes, it is. But it is not about violating copyright directly. What we have in the DMCA, just as you will recall, I hope, when we looked at 18 U.S.C. 1030, I hope you'll remember that after we went through this federally protected computer and that protected computer and access without permission to do this and to do that, and then it said it's illegal to traffic in passwords. Remember that? There was just this other offense within 18 U.S.C. 1030 that didn't sound like the others, but it was illegal to distribute passwords or other sorts of access methods and to distribute viruses. It was a separate offense. So too, within copyright, you have this anti-circumvention provision, and we have discussion of it here in the book, which is on page 535 to 536. So this is not about infringing copyright. This is about helping others to infringe copyright. And it prohibits a few things. One, it prohibits getting around copy protection. Anti-circumvention means not being allowed to go around, to circumvent. So this law prohibits breaking copyright protection. Someone puts in place something, physical or electronic, or software-based, to keep people from using a copyrighted work other than as permitted by the copyright holder. Someone else figures out a way around that block. If you figure out a way around that block, that is a violation of this statute. And if you then, having gone around the block, go ahead and make it illegal, make a copy without permission, that's a separate violation of copyright law. But the mere fact that you are going around, you are defeating the copy protection, that's a violation of these provisions. Or telling people how to do it. Trafficking in methods and technology of circumvention. The digital equivalent of selling lockpicks to non-locksmiths. And why did they have to do to put that into the law? Because with the millennium and the digitization of copyrighted work, copyright holders were left trying to prevent. The law already prohibited, but it wasn't working. They were left to try to prevent copying. Because suddenly, it was so easy. So, they didn't bother making LPs non-recordable because there was no real commercial impact. The first digital recording technology that was supposed to be marketed to consumers was the digital audio tape. The only people in this room who might ever have dealt with digital audio tape are those of you who have either been in the recording industry or the radio industry. Digital audio tape never made it to consumers, or by the time it did, it was essentially irrelevant because the music publishers sued to stop it. Because it was the first time that someone could easily make at home a perfect recording of a digital. So we went from LPs to CDs, and for a while that was okay because you couldn't make a CD at home. But then before we came out with CD burners, prior to that, I think it was Sony invented the digital audio tape. And if you recorded from a CD onto a digital audio tape, the digital audio tape version was exactly the same. It was perfect. It was digital, not analog. And if you took a DAT and recorded to another DAT, exactly the same quality. And so the record companies, the music companies, successfully sued and held off long enough. Ultimately, I think the way they came out was they required digital audio tape manufacturers to put a surcharge to raise the price on every blank tape sold that was supposed to go to a fund to reimburse the music companies. But by that time, people would come up with burnable CDs. So it became irrelevant. They were still very convenient because they could be re-recorded. They were much smaller. That's why reporters, radio stations, they've got digital audio tape players, but nobody else does. Software, the first thing they came out with when you first got a disc was software-based copy protection that you would put in your computer, and if you tried to just simply copy the files, there was software on those programs that would say, no, computer, don't let this be copied. This is commercial. And then someone figured out a way around that, cracked copy protection. And they came up with other copy protection. Someone came around. Then they started getting clever. And they started saying, in order for you to use this program in the first place, you have to tell us what the fifth word on the fourth paragraph on page 62 of the owner's manual is. And it wasn't always that paragraph of that word. They would randomly change it. And the idea was, it was very quick for the average consumer to copy a floppy disk. But to copy a 112-page, customer's manual, it would cost as much. People didn't have photocopiers handy. And so for a while, that sort of worked. And then that didn't work. And then they came out with programs that were so big, software that was so many, then no one would. It was on CD. We couldn't make CDs. And then we could make CDs. Then we have a problem again. So then we'll put it out on DVD. Can't make DVD. But at least if it's so big, it won't be distributed on the internet because people's connections are slow. and then they get faster. The technological solutions are always behind. They try something. That's why you need the legal solution. The legal solution says, even if you can't, you may not. It is now an offense to get around copyright protection, whether or not you then go ahead and infringe the copyright, and it's an offense to help other people do so. So, let's see this. And then there's fair use, and I want to talk about fair use because it's very important. And I think maybe we will discuss these cases next class, because I would like to discuss them, but without understanding the law, you don't really see where the problem lies. So I think somebody said about the T-shirt, right? The question about the T-shirt. And here's the problem. The theory is that if there's a copyrighted thing, an artwork, and you put it on a T-shirt and you don't have permission, that will be an infringement unless either there is an exception or a defense. Some things that are carved out as exceptions. Teachers, like me, are allowed to show in the classroom legally made copies of movies, even if the movies themselves aren't, even if I don't have an official public performance license. I can show you an Oscar screener, even if I'm not an Oscar voter, even if I'm not supposed to have that movie. I'm allowed to show it to you as a teacher in a classroom at a not-for-profit institution. There's a specific provision in the copyright law. Doesn't, in my view, apply to streaming video. If you're interested, I can share with you my piece on that. But either you have an exception or you have a defense. And fair use is a defense, but it's not an absolute defense. What the law says is, notwithstanding the fact that something is an infringement, there may be no liability if it's fair use. And what's fair use? It doesn't tell you. What it tells you are some of the things a court may consider. How much of what was used? Why is it being used? What was actually copied? How much of the piece of it? Was it the important bit? Was it the da-da-da-da part of the song? Or was it da-da? No one cares about that second part, but the first part's the really important bit. And what did it do to the marketplace? So to your T-shirt example. Copyrighted work. You're including it on a T-shirt. Even though if it wasn't on a T-shirt originally, that is a derivative work. As a basic matter, copyright, is it a satire? Right? The parody exception, that's an exception. No. It is a page from a modern comic book because you just wanted to sell it and you're just some guy. No offense. So you didn't go and get permission from the artists and the publisher. You're selling them for cost. So you're not making a lot of money. Or you're not selling them at all. You're just making T-shirts. You went out to Staples, right? So, what's your purpose? Is it commercial? No. What's the work? It's a comic book page. How much of that page of art are you using? All of it. Are you affecting the potential market for the value of the copyrighted work? Maybe. They may sell T-shirts or other kinds of things with that artwork. And by your just using it, that market may go. But will you know for sure? No. You will have to go to court, be sued, and raise this as a defense and win in order for you to have a sense of that. So I wouldn't do that if I were you.
I'm just bringing up the deal because it's like a common thing for like college groups, organizations, students, fraternities, like make T-shirts that like use either like a sports logo or like
an sure it is. And it's not legal. Yes, they do, which means nothing. But it's de minimis. No. Well, if it's parody, right? It's parody. Is it humorous? Or is it simply, we thought it would be cool to put our fraternity name in here? You're going to have to prove that it fits the legal definition of parody. That's the problem. All right. I'm going to leave the cases for the early part. We won't talk news next week. But between the news and the evaluations, we sort of lost that amount of time. So I want to start with and be prepared to discuss particularly the Napster case and the Corley case are the two. The Napster case is obviously the music distribution through peer-to-peer file sharing. And the Corley case, which is about an online publication that helped people learn about how to copy DVDs. And they're both kind of, they are very much important cases for these two doctrines. All right? And then we will continue. We're also going to talk about spyware, malware, spam, and phishing next week. So we're not adjusting the syllabus anymore. We will do both. Have a good day. And be prepared to vote next week. I want to talk to you for a second, if you have a minute.
Sure. And I have a question about the exam.
I leave it. Hold on.